I'm really glad to be here. Thanks a lot. And, you know, it's not often that somebody from Ohio State follows somebody from Michigan. It's usually the other way around. I'm talking about bone health being one of the things, but to some extent, Kathy had asked me to kind of tie in a lot of things that aren't sort of in the traditional care considerations, the very important areas of muscle strength and pulmonary and cardiology. You know, we have some good data on those things, but there are many other things that we want to talk about. I don't have any financial disclosures. I'll say up front that I'm going to mention some of the drugs that are used for the treatment of low bone density and osteoporosis, which have not been approved by the FDA for use in this age group, and so take that with a grain of salt. So I have been leading in the TDCI, which I think is a very exciting project, something we've kind of termed the metabolic committee. We're hitting endocrine issues, bone issues, GI issues, stomach constipation, kidney stones, and lots of very important stuff. So I'll start with the endocrine issues. And so this is a little diagram of how the pituitary gland works. And I labored over this for a long time in medical school. And I have told everybody that I've been working with on this TDCI project that I'm not an endocrinologist. And I am very careful to tell people that. But I have sort of a working knowledge of what happens. And so the pituitary gland sits in the middle of your brain. And it's the master gland of the body. It tells the other glands in the body what to do and when to do it. And when we give our patients or anybody else large doses of corticosteroids, prednisone, deflazacort, or whatever, to one degree or another, we can shut off what the pituitary gland is doing. Now, there are 8 hormones that the pituitary gland makes, and I think we have pretty good evidence that 4 of them get shut off by the high doses of steroids. And so that's growth hormone. There's 2 sex hormones called LH and FSH, and the 4th one is ACTH, which is the hormone that drives the adrenal gland to make cortisone. And so it doesn't need to do it because we're giving the steroids. But giving these high doses of steroids disrupt these endocrine glands and result in a lot of the things that we see pretty frequently. The failure to grow high enough, the delayed puberty, problems with glucose metabolism. The ACTH cortisone is very intimately involved in glucose metabolism. And so these are the problems that we see with our guys that take large doses of corticosteroids. And so we had put forth a screening for diabetes in some way as something that we think is a reasonable thing to be done within the Duchenne clinics where the patients are getting steroids, and I think most people would agree with that. Now, we've debated long and hard about what's the proper way to do that, and I think there's evidence in many different ways. You should do fasting glucose. You should do random glucose. You should check something called the hemoglobin A1C. You should check. These are all blood tests. A lot of people don't like getting blood tests, so we should check the urine for glucose. And so we haven't, I think, really decided what it is the thing that we're going to recommend that people be checking, but the fact that you're giving somebody steroids and you're worrying about their glucose metabolism, we think is an important thing. Okay, a few slides now on bone health, which is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about and working on. The bones are an interesting organ, and a lot of people don't think of the bones as an organ, and they don't think of the bones as a live organ. You think, well, bone is bone, it's just there. But bone is actually a very interesting, dynamic organ. It's interesting to me anyway. And the process of growth and even the process of living with bones is a dynamic process. And there's constantly calcium going into the bones and coming back out of the bones. Most of the calcium in your body is in your bones. And so when your body senses that your blood calcium has come down a little bit, it sucks it out of the bones. When it's got enough, it starts putting calcium back into the bones. And the bone is constantly being remodeled. And there are many, many hormones and other forces that govern how the bone is remodeled. And really the biggest thing for making the bones grow stronger, particularly in children and adolescents and young adults, is using the bones. And there are many hormonal factors that make the bone stronger when you use your bones. And even just in people who don't have Duchenne are typically developed kind of people, you can see much better bone density in athletes who put strain on their bones, runners, soccer players, anybody that does that, much more than equally elite athletes who mainly swim. Swimming doesn't have that same stress on the bones. And so if you extrapolate that back out to guys with Duchenne who start walking less and less, they put less and less stress on the bones, and thereby the bones don't get as strong as they should. And then you give the guy steroids, and that really shuts off the influx of calcium into the bones and favors resorption of bone. And so even the bone that was there before starts getting resorbed. And corticosteroids are a very well-known detriment to bone function, which is not to say people shouldn't take corticosteroids, but when you're weighing, taking steroids, not taking steroids, hopefully one day we can figure out what the dose of steroids is that's good enough to prevent muscle loss, but not so bad as to cause bone loss. That'd be really the sweet spot. I don't think we have that data yet. In addition, any medicine that decreases the amount of acid in the stomach, like Prilosec, Nexium, Zantac, all those things, is also known to be not great for the bones because the stomach needs that acid in order to absorb calcium. So calcium ingestion is very important. And having heartburn is terrible, and I am a sufferer myself, and despite what it might be doing to my bones, I take these medicines every day. Every time I say, you know, I've been feeling pretty good and I'd really like my bones to be stronger and stop them, I really pay for it a couple days later. So I just stay on it. But there's a lot of detriment to the corticosteroids. And so they cause nutritional problems at the macronutrient level. Those are the big nutrients, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. And also at the micronutrient levels in terms of vitamins and minerals. Now, as some of the guys start having more and more trouble swallowing, they may need nutritional supplementation, either through supplemental things like Boost or Pediasure, some kind of oral shake, and some of the guys will get feeding tubes and get their nutrition through there. But our guys really have an important, and we're coming to recognize an important need for calcium supplementation and vitamin D supplementation, and for no other reason than most people in America don't get enough calcium and vitamin D. Vitamin D is a hormone predominantly made by the skin in response to exposure to sunlight, and in order to get enough sunlight, you got to spend I think it's an hour outside every day, and you got to live somewhere south of the middle of the country, and so we spend more and more time indoors. Many of us live in Ohio, Michigan, and places where it's too far north to get enough vitamin D, and so we do need to supplement that for most people. The way that we test bone density, there's a few, and none of them are perfect, and I want to put that out there right up front to say that none of these are perfect. This is a bone density machine, what's called a DEXA, dual energy X-ray absorptimeter, and the test itself is reasonably painless. You lay on that cushiony thing, and that arm moves over you, and it shoots X-rays down through you and counts how many come out the other side. And all the ones that don't come out are assumed to have been absorbed by your body. There are other ways of doing this. There's a peripheral CT scan. There's an ultrasound that they sometimes do of the heel. But really, the best data that we have, and the data's not great, but the best data we have all has to do with this DEXA machine. And I don't want to bore you with this particular thing, but when you get a DEXA scan, you should come back with something called a Z-score. And the Z-score is basically a number of standard deviations that your bone density is away from the average young boy, same age, same height as the kid that we put on the DEXA machine. And if we say it's less than 2, then that's 2 standard deviations below the average for those kids, and we think that that's a problem. We call that low bone mass. Now, if a kid has had a fracture, then we would say that person not only has low bone mass, they also have osteoporosis. But somebody who's not had a fracture, or at least a pathologic fracture, and by that it's, you know, did you fall and break something when the average person would not have broken something doing the same thing, that's osteoporosis. there's a couple reasons, you know, again, the positioning, if the bones are too small, if the bones are deformed, if there's significant scoliosis, it can be hard to interpret these things. And so it's not just a matter of, oh, go get a DEXA scan and now you know the answer. There's actually quite a bit of interpretation that can go along with that. I think we've stopped short of saying everybody should be getting a DEXA scan. But I think we felt pretty good saying everybody ought to get their vitamin D checked. That's a blood test. We have ways to make it better. And so when we know that there's low vitamin D, we can give somebody vitamin D and make it better. Vitamin D does many things, and every day in the newspaper you can read some other study that came out, and vitamin D is low in people with MS. Vitamin D is low in people with lupus. Vitamin D is low in people with depression. Giving people with fibromyalgia, a disease of unexplained joint and fatigue, vitamin D can make that better. So vitamin D we think is pretty good for you. It's got a large therapeutic window, which means we can give you pretty good doses before we get into the toxic range. And I check any patient that I see that doesn't walk for their vitamin D level. But what else can we do about low bone density? Well, the number one would be making sure people get enough nutrition, calcium and vitamin D especially. There's some amount of magnesium that's probably needed for this. Talking to a dietitian can be helpful. There's some data that even using the bones passively in something like a stander, the first time a stander was explained to me, I was like, oh, like that thing they had Hannibal Lecter in the movie. And I think some of the kids who use standers think of it as something like that, if they don't like being in it. But loading the bones even passively through a stander may be good for bone density. And then we have these pharmacologic agents that can improve bone density. The bisphosphonates are the medicines like alendronate or Fosamax, zolendronate, Zometa. The one Sally Field advertises is ibandronate or Boniva. As far as I know, we've not been able to say one is better than another. They have side effects of their own, but they are something that some guys with Duchenne do take to improve their bone density. And there's a newer medicine called teriparatide, the brand name of which is Forteo, which is an analog of another hormone which makes the bone strong. Very little data in children, very little data in Duchenne, if any. So just to put it out there that it's out there, and it's something that your doctors might talk to you about. Okay, nutrition. Moving on from bone, between the steroids and just in general being an American, we don't get good nutrition, either in the macronutrients, again, fats, carbohydrates, and protein, and there are lots of micronutrient deficiencies that are out there if you are eating a very restricted diet, as some of our guys do. Now, a big problem I have found in the guys with Duchenne is not enough fluid intake, and a lot of that has to do with, well, they don't want to stop and pee. And stopping to use the bathroom may be, you know, really quite an endeavor to get out of the chair, get up to the urinal or the toilet. But it's really, really important to stay well enough hydrated, particularly when it's hot and humid out like it is today. I have a kidney stones, a preview, are bad. And if you are not well enough hydrated, that can predispose you to kidney stones. Some of the kids will require some amount of supplemental oral feeding if there is worsening jaw musculature and trouble chewing like meat and other kinds of things that people may start taking Boost, Ensure, something like that. And then some of the kids will get feeding tubes as well. And we thought just as a basic thing that we'd really want you to be getting in your Duchenne clinic is your height and weight checked. And we debated endlessly, hey, how do you do this? How do you get a guy on the scale if they're in the chair? And what if you don't have a lift to get the kid out of the chair? And what if they have scoliosis? And how do you measure their height and all these things? And I'll say we haven't come up with a great answer for that, for all of those things. But as a basic thing, we really think if you go to a doctor's office, they ought to be able to figure out some way to get your height and weight. And if you're going to a clinic that doesn't have a way to weigh you, they need to figure out some way to weigh you. It's really important for your health. There are lots of GI, gastrointestinal, stomach problems, dysphagia or trouble swallowing, reflux or heartburn, and constipation. Those last two, reflux and constipation, I think are really big detriments to quality of life. And, you know, anybody who's ever been constipated will tell you it just weighs on you through the day. And it's tough to do anything else or concentrate on anything else if you're badly constipated. And you may not eat as well if you're badly constipated. And the medicines you take may not be absorbed as well if you're badly constipated. And so what can you do to not be so constipated? Number one is drink more fluid. Number two is eat more fiber. And the third thing is there are medicines that help with constipation, and lots of you may be on them already. The dysphagia, as it's progressive, may necessitate, you know, there are things other than, oh, they start having trouble swallowing, they have to get a feeding tube. There are things that can be manipulated in terms of the textures or the consistency of the food. Therapy can sometimes help with techniques to improve the ability to swallow. And some people will decide to get feeding tubes, but it doesn't have to be everybody. Kidney stones, in my practice, which has a lot of adults with Duchenne, I found to be a very big problem, a very severe problem. These are painful. Anybody who's had a kidney stone will tell you, you don't want a kidney stone. They're little tiny things. They're like grains of sand, but you know they will put anybody into hysterics. Very painful, sometimes require medical interventions with anesthesia to get these out. Bad. Why do you get them? Well, all that calcium that's being sucked out of the bones is being filtered through the kidney, and so there are other kidney stones other than calcium stones, but the majority have to do with that kind of thing, as well as not being well enough hydrated. And so I'll put that plea in there again for hydration. It's super important. I did this little study of guys with Duchenne versus similarly immobile patients with CP that I saw. And there we saw a lot more kidney stones in the guys with Duchenne. And why that is, we don't know. But we certainly did see it, and I've seen it in my adults with other muscle diseases, and not as much with my patients with CP. Sometimes, but not as much. They also asked me to talk about dental problems, and I hope there isn't anybody British in the audience to be offended by this slide. But, of course, go to the dentist. It's very, very important to you. Why is it important to you? Well, you know, if take care of your teeth, they'll take care of you. Especially if you have heart problems or maybe one day might be getting some kind of cardiac intervention or cardiac device, having a good, healthy mouth is very important for that. And as the guys start eating orally less, the teeth get worse. And you'd think that, well, they're putting less sugar on their teeth and things should get better. But it's actually that eating motion and the amount of saliva in their mouth that keeps the teeth healthy. The last thing I wanted to cover that we talked a little bit about, and we talked a lot in this last bit about this transition and, you know, this the psychosocial considerations of what should happen when you go to your doctor for your Duchenne. And the basic thing I want to know when I see patients is, how are you? I understand you have Duchenne. I understand you have problems. I understand we have things that we're going to need to talk about in terms of your lungs and your heart and your bones and all those things, but how are you? How do you feel? Are you having pain? Are you having problems with mood or with your mood or your anxiety? Are you sleeping okay? How are you doing in school? How are you dealing with your friends? How are you dealing with your parents? How are you dealing with the fact that you have Duchenne muscular dystrophy? These are the real important things to talk about. And sometimes in medicine, oftentimes in medicine, we get bogged down in, okay, the heart function is this and the pulmonary function is this, but your doctor who's taking care of your heart and your lungs, they really care about this. How are you doing? And when I have parents call me and say, oh, you know, I'm so worried, the pulse ox is this and the heart rate is this, and, you know, I'll say, but okay, how are they? I'm not as interested in those numbers as how are they feeling. And of course, in Duchenne, we have the luxury of most of the guys can say, well, I feel like I'm having trouble breathing. I feel this terrible pain in my back, and there's blood in my urine. That's a kidney stone. I feel pain in my stomach. I'm sad. I'm worried about my mom's back as I get bigger. So these things are really, really important. And these are the things that we need to be talking about with our patients. And so I want to just introduce these words to you, palliative care, in case you haven't heard them before. It's not the same thing as hospice. It doesn't mean you're dying. But palliative care is a service that, or a way of practicing medicine that focuses on communication, that focuses on controlling symptoms, and focuses on improving the quality of life for people that have a chronic illness. If you are living with a chronic illness, and that's if you have Duchenne, these concepts of how are you, and not just how are your pieces and parts, are extraordinarily important. And if you have doctors that you like, that communicate well with you, that are attentive to the symptoms that you're having, or attentive to the big picture of what it's like to be a person with Duchenne, then you're getting palliative care, even if you're not getting palliative care from a formal board-certified expert in palliative care, of which there are many, and there may be in your institution. And so if you feel like you're missing that from your interactions in the clinics that you're going to, it could be something to bring up. Like, yes, we want to hear about the latest research. Yes, we want to know what the echo and the cardiac MRI and the PFTs and the chest X-ray and all of these things show. But we also want to focus on the person that has this disease and how we can make their life better and how we can make their life not just longer, but make their life better. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thanks. There's questions.
All right, so it's time for questions, and we're exactly on time, so this will probably be the only moment in the next few days that that's occurring. So if you have questions for Dr. Noritz or for Gary, please come to the – I think there are microphones. So any questions? Jill.
Is it going to work? I'm so loud, I don't even need a microphone. Okay, thank you for your presentation on GI, and my question to you is, a lot of our boys who are on steroids seem to get bacterial imbalances sometimes, and so I'm wondering if anybody's looked at probiotics as a way to keep their GI healthy without having to do the Miralax all the time?
I don't know of studies, but there is increasing evidence in general, certainly about the use of probiotics when somebody is taking antibiotics. And so I've started the practice of, you know, if I'm giving you antibiotics for something, to also give you probiotics to decrease the risk of C. diff, which is this infection you can get after antibiotics. All probiotics are not the same. When you go to the store, you can spend this amount of money or that amount of money on probiotics. And they're not standardized, and so I think it is pretty hard to do studies in that realm. Specifically, if you find it's certainly worth a try in my mind. If constipation is a problem, to try the probiotics are certainly a reasonable thing to try. I use a lot of Miralax. It's not the only thing in the world that can be done for somebody who's constipated, but it's pretty good. But I don't think there's any objection to probiotics.
Thank you.
Sure. Pulmonologist from Albania. Thank you for your presentations. I would like to know if you have your experience about the phenotypes in Duchenne, which would be very useful according to the profile of treatment, to make a more detailed treatment, not a treatment common for all the patients, if you know. For example, the survival is not the same to the group of patients. The complications are not the same. Some make heart complications, some make bone complications, some make renal failure or many. So there are phenotypes, and of course, according to phenotypes, this could lead us to endotypes also.
It's a great point, and one that I think there isn't a straight answer to at present, though something that I think is being actively looked into. So I would take, for example, the variability in cardiac phenotype. This is certainly something that is being examined very intensely by multiple different groups with the hope, I believe, of identifying what factors contribute to either very early presentation or very late presentation, and then hopefully tailoring therapy towards the specific subset of cardiac involvement that you might fall into. So, for example, if there was a way to predict who is going to be a child with very severe early cardiac involvement, that might be a child who gets medications sooner than somebody who's going to have late involvement. So that's the goal, but I just don't think we're there yet in terms of understanding.
And another question is, what is your opinion about the place that take Viagra in the treatment of these patients?
I don't have a formal opinion, but there's a clinical trial ongoing, which I think will hopefully provide an opinion on whether or not this is something that's helpful. So
there are some sessions later on more specifically on cardiac function. And
not only for cardiac function, but also for pulmonary hypertension in these patients. And
I don't think that's either of our areas.
Yeah, it's being looked at from the cardiac perspective, which I think will be the first step.
Thank you very much.
Sure. The genotype-phenotype thing is very interesting, and you see this in brothers who have the same gene and have different presentations and so on. And why that happens, we don't know, and we're working on that.
Yeah. I mean, there's clearly now identified genetic variants that are distinct from the dystrophin gene mutation itself that can predict severity, in particular as relates to loss of ambulation. But in terms of other clinical outcomes, it's still being examined.
Hi, I just want to quickly ask, at what point, my little guy's only been on corticosteroids for a little over a year, at what point do I need to start really considering the bone density and start getting that tested and, you know, we're at the beginning stages of it, so...
Right. Again, we don't have the data to say this is when you should do it. In our clinic in Columbus, we've started talking about it and saying, you know, we probably ought to get one before we start them on the steroids and then see how the steroids do to it. But, again, we don't have the data that says this is the right way to do it. I think one of the other things we've talked about is, you know, doing it once a year for patients on steroids.
And I think the other thing I'd say would be, I'm sure that you do the same, we recommend just optimal bone health from the outset, regardless of steroid use or not, in terms of thinking about a multivitamin with vitamin D supplementation, drinking milk, and trying to get outside as much as possible because the best source of vitamin D is sunlight. So these are things that we standardly recommend from the outset, regardless of whether the child is on steroids or not.
Thank you. And Dr. Norwich, OH.
Oh, I.O. So two or three servings of dairy ought to get the usual person enough calcium for the day.
Hi. My question's almost similar to her as far as standards of care go, because we are actually in the same clinic. My son sees you. But and she asked about when to start this. My son actually started Fosamax at age 8 when he started steroids. They were prescribed, and we're in the same clinic. So, is it in the standard? Haven't read them lately.
In the current standard documents, it's not there. And we don't have data that says that's the good way to do it, not this way. And so, there's still very much a lot of. A clinician variability. Do you want to talk about that point in general about what's standard and then what's where's room for clinician decision making?
Yeah. So I think that points out a very good example of what one of the goals behind the TDCI is to try to address these types of variables that are being looked at by different clinicians in terms of some individuals being on Fosamax, some not, some getting DEXA, some not. We don't know what the right answer is. And so trying to find out what we should be doing and how that's affecting outcomes is really critical because, again, there's a lot of things that we could do, and so it's always a question of whether doing everything is really the right decision. And the best guidelines we have are the printed, the published standard of care documents, and as is mentioned, the Fosamax is not part of the standard of care document, but there's also – these are not – proven things in a lot of circumstances. So we don't have the randomized data to support when to do a DEXA scan or when to start Fosamax.
And then I had a specific question regarding kidney stones, because we have those too. Is there another way, I mean, testing for kidney stones, aside from doing a standard X-ray laying on the table, because as you mentioned earlier, it is hard for the kids to actually get onto a table and lay there. It's very painful. Is there any other way to get to manage this in, besides an X-ray?
You can, it's not, there's not great ways. And so you either have to lay down for a CAT scan, a plain X-ray, or an ultrasound. It's tough to do. Sometimes, depending on the position in the chair, you could do an ultrasound in the chair, but it's hard. And a lot of bowel gas gets in the way. Testing the urine for blood is not a great way to do it, but it may give you a clue as to whether there's a stone or not.
Thank you.
You want to go, Mindy?
Should I go? Mm-hmm. I'll just, hopefully I'll just talk. Just easier to give him a Ducasate pill every morning than to do all that mixing, and you get sludge at the bottom, and he doesn't drink it.
Yeah.
Is there any harm in doing that?
No, you know, with bowels, my answer is always whatever's working.
It works pretty good for you. FYI.
just on the subject of stool softeners, which or bowel management, which is where I seem to spend most of my time. We have things to soften the stool. Miralax is a stool softener, but there are other ways to soften the stool to get more liquid into the stool to make it mushier, if you will. Docusate's one of them, Miralax, Lactulose. All that does is make it softer. It doesn't make it move forward. And so sometimes we need medicines to move the bowels forward, and the ones we use most for that are Senna and... I'm on the spot now. I'm blanking on it. Somebody shout it out. And anyway, but something that's actually a stimulant laxative to make the bowels move through. And then the third addition to the regimen, which is needed sometimes, is something to get things moving from below, like an enema or a suppository. So those sort of three categories of things can be used, and whatever works for you works for you. And if it's not working, there are lots of other options.
I just have another question about, this seems stupid to me, but my husband wanted me to ask. I mean, the kids have Duchenne, so, I mean, what harm can radiation do? But is there a risk of all these radiation-type testing?
I would say yes, and we talk
about... So he's right again, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, go figure. It adds up over time, you know? If you flew here from California, you got a good dose of radiation in the plane. There's radiation around us all the time. But you add in radiation with an X-ray, there's a bit. With a DEXA, there's a bit. With a CAT scan, there's a lot. With an MRI or an ultrasound, there's none. And if you are now going to live to be 40 years old, 45 years old, or we don't even know these days how long the life expectancy may well be, it does add up. And so I think it's just important to say, you know, we're going to get X-rays when we need them for something, and we're not going to get them just to check on things that we don't need to know about. I think it's a great question.
So 4 years ago, I was in this boat of what do we do about bone health? We have a doctor in Ottawa that I'm working with, but didn't really know who she was, and we just had our baseline study with her. So what she's been doing is, prior to steroids, she has been doing baseline DEXAs, and she also does spine X-rays. And as soon as she starts to see signs of spinal compression on the vertebrae and or compression fractures and pain at that site in the boys, she's treating with IV zoledronate. And, I mean, just we've been very happy with this, but because your comments about DEXA being somewhat variable, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about pairing that with a spine and or a bone age X-ray of the hand?
So a bone age X-ray of the hand is something you get a shot of the wrist, and there are sort of standards that the radiologist will look at and say, oh, you have the bone age of a 7-year-old, and if you're 9 years old, then it's delayed. The lateral spine films to look for compression fractures, you can do that. Actually, the DEXA scan itself can do that if you set it in a certain way. I think it's, you know, since we know that the guys get compression fractures, it's certainly reasonable to look for them, and that may well be the thing to act on. Now, a lot of the variability in the way that the DEXA is interpreted or positioning, and there's a lot that goes into it. As long as you're doing it with the same tech on the same machine at the same center, if you're following a kid over time, their DEXA was this, and this year it's that, and the next year it's that. That takes away a lot of that variability. But I do worry about, you know, getting somebody a DEXA for the first time and the number's miserable, and you know, and not looking carefully at it to say, okay, were they positioned right? Did the computer draw the boxes correctly? Is their scoliosis so bad that you don't know what to make of it? Did the tech enter the kid's age into the computer wrong? And that can throw off what that number is going to be. But, you know, in a setting where it's consistent, I think that that's great. And you should publish that because we don't have a lot of that data.
She's actually trying to get funding for a study right now.
Okay, but she's got the data she has, and I think that even that would be good. Cool.
Dr. Dowling, you were talking about establishing best practices for in clinics. Isn't there a danger in settling, coming up with best practices in that it's going to stop different clinics from experimenting a little bit to see if they can improve on things?
I guess I wouldn't view it that way so much as thinking that there's a minimum set of clinical care that should be provided by every clinic. There'll be clinics that are providing more than that minimum standard, and this shouldn't be a disincentive to that. What it's hopefully designed to do is to get all of the clinics on the same page and the same playing field, so
okay.
that everyone is.
So it's more of a it's a minimum set of practices that they know are going to benefit the
right.
child, and then beyond that, there might be some others. And experimentation is certainly okay beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And I think okay. the idea would be that. You know, if there are these things that are, as you're saying, experiments or not within the current practice guidelines, if they are resulting in better benefits, then they would become part of the standard of practice over time.
Okay. That
by assessing not just what clinics are doing, but also what their outcomes are, that we can start to see, you know, if Clinic X is doing something that no other clinic is doing, they're, you know, keeping a standard BMI of every patient at 20, and we find out that, well, all of their patients are doing better, or the majority are doing better than in other clinics, then that might be something that needs to be looked into as a standard practice.
I got it. Thank you very much.
Question?
I just want to quickly ask, do you have any recommendations for your low bone density and the kids standing on standers? Like, I don't know, if they've got low bone density, then there's a contraindication to standing on a stander or...
Again, no data. I would think that if and some people believe that it can improve the bone density. So if it can be done comfortably, and the person doesn't hate doing it, I think it could be worthwhile. The data in CP at least suggests that you got to stand like 2 hours a day to really get benefit from it. Probably every little bit helps. I think it could, you know, done correctly, it should be safe without a whole lot of downsides. Could your bonus be low enough that you put somebody up and they get a fracture from that? I think it's possible, but I don't think it's too likely. I'll cross my fingers on that.
Thank you.
Hello. Do you believe that starting with steroids too early gets worse with the bone health? Or you can calibrate a dosage where things will be better. You understand?
Yeah.
Good.
I mean, I think it's... So, you know, right now the standard thought is that we start steroids at around age 4 as the earliest. And just anecdotally, I can't say that I would see I've seen any correlation between starting at 4, 5, or 6 and having more or less bone involvement. There seems to be quite a bit of variability, though relative uniformity of osteoporosis in all boys who are chronically steroid treated. I think this is something that's will hopefully come out from studies like the Synergy study that's looking at thousands of individuals over a longitudinal period of time as to whether or not there's this correlation. I don't know.
My thought in general is more steroids, worse for bone, but that's obviously not the only consideration. And the answer is when to start steroids, I think, depends on their muscular dystrophy, not just on their bone health.
So maybe a general approach where you took care with vitamins and other things to counterbalance the effects of the steroids.
If we know about the kids early enough to really build their bones up as much as we can before the steroids, I think that can only be good.
Okay, thanks.
Do we have any evidence that growth hormones helping bone density?
I'm not an endocrinologist, and I don't know that literature real well. I do know that in general, growth hormone deficiency is bad for your bones, and growth hormone helps build your bones. I don't know about the specific Duchenne literature, and I know that there are guys with Duchenne in places that are taking growth hormone. I don't know the answer.
I just one thing, we are on growth hormone, and at UCLA they did an MRI of my son's brain, and we did find a small pituitary gland. I know that's not standard practice.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's any correlation between chronic steroid use and a small pituitary gland?
I don't know that, and I more important than the size of the pituitary gland is what the hormones are doing, I think. So whether that's even
test
related
two,
to the Duchenne, two, I don't
two,
know.
Test two.
That is interesting.
Two.
Thank you for two really wonderful presentations. On the
test
issue
two,
of
two.
Calcium...
Two.
I came to understand that you said just 3 servings of dairy products a day would probably be sufficient to provide the calcium that you need. Does that mean that you are not advocating for calcium supplementation or vitamin D supplementation?
Yeah.
And if so, then how much?
Well, so I have... in my practice, the luxury of I work with a dietitian most of the time who can say, as a very like easy way I think about it, 8 ounces of milk has about 500 milligrams of calcium. The average person needs, in this age group needs 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams. You should drink 3 servings of whatever a day, three calcium servings. If it sounds like they're really getting reliably 3 servings of dairy a day, I don't recommend extra calcium unless the dietitian has really sort of broken it down and said, they're really not getting it. And just to make it easy, if they reliably get 2 servings a day, I say take 500 milligrams of calcium a day. But I try to get them up to that 500 milligrams.
Do you make a vitamin D recommendation with that?
So the average, I usually will check the blood level. And if the level's low, being less than 30, I'll give 2,000 units a day. And then I'll check it again, and if it's still low, I'll give 4,000 units a day. There are actually many ways to do the vitamin D dosing, but I usually go off the blood level rather than the dietary intake.
So thank you. That gives us a little guidance. So my concern, as I think about the potential drawback to calcium supplementation is that calcium is also one of the final endpoints in cellular death. And I don't know any thoughts on the implications that might have.
A limiting factor I see in calcium supplementation sometimes is constipation. And I see that more, I can ask questions about that better than I can ask about cellular death. Certainly. The other, there has been some studies in the last couple of years about in large studies, mainly in older people, of calcium supplementation in earlier coronary disease, and calcium can deposit in the coronary arteries. And to some extent, I've just, I our guys have different heart problems, not coronary problems necessarily. So by and large, you know, I don't think that it's not excessive calcium. Any excessive calcium, the body should pee out. So I wouldn't, you know, our guys already have trouble peeing out all the calcium they got. So, you know, getting up to that sort of recommendation should be okay in my book.
So if you're going to supplement, not aggressively, but...
Yeah, I'm not real aggressive with it.
Thank you.
And just in terms of the cell death, if you're thinking about muscular death of myofibers, the amount of calcium that's actually in the sarcoplasm of the muscle fiber is incredibly low. So the difference between the blood and the muscle is so very different that more or less in the blood isn't going to change how much calcium is getting into the muscle. If there are tears because the membrane has lost its integrity and there's calcium coming in, and that's one of the mechanisms that's promoting cell death, that wouldn't be influenced by having more or less serum calcium. So it's more related to the dynamics within the muscle fiber itself.
Thank you.
One last question.
Hi, my son's 10, and he was diagnosed with osteo last year and on Fosamax. I'm just wondering if there's been a study done on the average age of the onset for osteo.
I don't know. Okay.
That might end up coming out of the Synergy data. I think that's one of the things that the Synergy is this big study, multi-center study looking at the natural history of Duchenne. There's another natural history study ongoing, and out of that might come more information related to when osteoporosis is developing.
All right. I think to a large extent, it's often there when we think to look for it. And so if we don't look till you're 10, does that mean it started when you're 10 or it started when you're 8 or when it... If we start looking for it more, we may find out when that age is if we test more and more younger people.
Right, okay. Thank you.
And Craig McDonald's going to be Skyped in. His wife is having surgery, so... he's not here, but we'll Skype him in. He's in charge and leading that natural history study, so perhaps that's a question we can direct at him as well. All right, thank you very much, Jim and Gary. We so appreciate it.